So this myth that earlier is better is affecting, it's affecting parents because it's making things more challenging for them. It's affecting the children for sure, the whole profession of early childhood education, the teachers, and it has to be stopped. You know, it has to be stopped.
And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Be a part of it for as low as $5 a month and get access to one-on-one coaching with me for as low as $20 a month.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people who can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I have for you a legend in the early childhood space, Ray Pika, a legend, and I would say a revolutionary, but I'll let her introduce herself. And then we'll get started with the conversation. Today we are talking about the myths of early childhood, but we'll dive deeper into that after she introduces herself. Go ahead, Ray Pika.
Hi, Mr. Chaz, thank you. I don't know about legendary, trying to be a revolutionary. I've been an early childhood education consultant for 41 years.
41
years. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. You can tell by all the white hair. And I've written 21 books, working on the 22nd. Seem to have a bit of a writing disease. I create online courses and I keynote and, you know, I do a whole lot of things. But lately, a lot of it has been about advocacy, you know, speaking up. And so there's the revolution part, you know, Ray's revolution. I'm trying to get early childhood professionals to speak up for the children, for themselves, for the field. And that's what the 22nd book is about. And my latest project is helping to inform parents about these myths. So that's, that's my latest mission.
So, okay, let's jump into it. So what are the myths that, what are the myths of early childhood that maybe parents and teachers may not know? Inform us, let's talk about it.
Yeah, I think teachers are pretty aware. Well, I think most teachers are pretty aware of this. Maybe not some of the young ones coming up, I'm not sure, but the one that has become deeply embedded in our society is the idea that earlier is better, which means that adults, not just parents, you know, it includes the administrators and the policymakers, seem to believe that we have to give children a jump start on success. And, you know, that means letters and numbers from the time you're 2 days old. And I'm exaggerating.
Are you though? I don't know. I definitely see letters and numbers in infant spaces sometimes, but go ahead, continue.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I saw a crib with a screen, a computer screen built into the inside of the, I mean, yeah, an infant lapware and, you know, trying to get babies to read and all of that. And the one that I heard most recently is about a MasterChef level training program for 6-month-olds. And you have to wonder what is involved in that.
Yeah.
You know,
what does that look like?
I don't think they're wielding knives at 6 months old. I don't know. I can't imagine what that looks like. You know, even the mom who I heard enrolled her little one at 4 months old in preschool prep. I don't know what that looks like either. What does preschool prep look like at 4 months old? Anyway, this whole idea that earlier is better is it's impacting early childhood education because that's where the push down in curriculum has come from. you know, the University of Virginia study that showed that kindergarten has become the new first grade. And from what we've seen, I'm sure you too, Mr. Chaz, the preschool has become the new kindergarten. And it's putting so much pressure on the children. A lot of the teachers are either depressed and burning out because they're being forced by administration or, you know, by parents who are shopping around and looking for preschools and just avoiding the play-oriented preschools in favor of the academics-oriented ones. And a lot of the good teachers are quitting because they refuse to subject the children to this. It's just making them so unhappy. So this myth that early is better is affecting parents because it's making things more challenging for them. It's affecting the children for sure. The whole profession of early childhood education, the teachers, and it has to be stopped. You know, it has to be stopped.
Yeah. Okay. So that was advocate here. My thought process as I'm a new parent, or this is my first child, and you know, I'm stressing out about how they're going to do in kindergarten. They're going to go to public school, you know, for the first time, and I know that the expectations, like you said, the expectations are higher, and they've gotten higher and higher. Kindergarten's the new first grade, and I know that I know as a teacher that there is a huge, like you were talking, there's a huge expectation for children to know their numbers and letters and sounds before they get to kindergarten, to pretty much to have that down. And if there's also too, and I remember as a teacher that there were these tests that we would do with children from as young as we would. So the test, so there was like the PALS test, which is like a literacy test, and that's just testing their literacy skills. So it's testing their current word awareness. It's testing if they can identify letters. If they can identify the sounds. Can they write their name? You know, so it's kind of stuff like that. And this was kind of like a big test and a big deal. And it was something because it was something that was measurable and that kind of everyone was on the same, I guess, measure, because the test was executed in a certain way. And that this was something that kindergartens would ask for before, you know, the child would go into their kindergarten school. Now for private schools, it sometimes required that they have taken these screening tests and have done well on them to get into certain schools. And then for some schools, and I think it's more public schools, would use these tests to kind of place children to decide like where they're going to be or like what class they're going to be. But using this data, using this test that this four-year-old took, that the kindergarten's going to use. So you can imagine as a parent being that, creating maybe a lot of anxiety and maybe just like, oh, I need to prepare. I don't want to be the only one behind. Everyone else is doing it. This is normal, right? Everyone's taking this test and the schools are asking for it. And so they're expecting it. So I can't have my child be the one that's behind. So yeah. I hear you, okay, earlier is not better. Maybe we shouldn't push the numbers and letters on them and try so hard to get them to memorize or learn it so young. Mm-hmm. But what if they get to kindergarten and they feel behind because other kids do know those things? What would your response be to that parent? What would you suggest that parent do? Like, talk to me. Like, I am that concerned, anxious parent who just wants the best for the child and doesn't want my child to be blindsided. I want them to go into this public school education system and be successful. Talk to me. Ray, I don't know what to do.
Of course you don't. There are few things that haven't changed over the ages. You want the best for your child, right? You're scared of getting it wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big worry, and there's no easier group of people to scare than parents. And the other thing that hasn't changed is children. Children have not changed. We might think that they're more advanced today because, you know, there's more information out there coming at them. They have more opportunity to gain information. But children haven't changed, nor has child development. It cannot be rushed. We can't accelerate child development. So when we try, we put too much pressure on the children. You know, if we're trying to make them read and write by kindergarten, then we're trying to go against the laws of nature. And who are we to think that nature has a, you know, we have a better plan than nature did? I mean, there are certain processes in place. It's called child development. So I would hope that as a parent, you would, to borrow a phrase, just say no. You know, to let him or her know that it's okay. The thing is, we do need the numbers. We do need parents to stick together. We need parents to say no to the administrators. We need parents to say no to the policymakers who are, you know, making policy like the Common Core kindergarten standards that said they had to read, children had to read by the end of kindergarten, and were developed by who knows who. You know, these policymakers don't have any knowledge of child development or education policies. What if they just plucking stuff out of the sky? There was not one single early childhood expert or teacher among the 135 who developed the kindergarten standards, Common Core standards for kindergarten. It's, you know, so we need parents to see the truth and to stand up for the truth, so as not to put this kind of pressure on children, because the little ones want very much to please us, and when they can't, because they're not developmentally equipped to do so, they feel like failures, you know, at 3, 4, and 5 years old. And as you were talking, you know, the what if, I kept thinking, what if?
Get it, let it out. Express those feelings, Ray.
What if we prepared schools for children instead of this nonsense about preparing children for schools? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, really, why do we have to make them fit into some sort of mold before they get there? I can't imagine giving those four-year-olds that kind of test. You know, write their name. Give me a break.
Yeah. So, sorry. All right. So now I'm the policymaker. We're playing here. So now I'm taking off my parent hat, and now I'm policymaker hat. And
I'm really mad at you now.
Okay. Yeah, so you're mad at me. I'm making the policies. You say, Ray, that earlier is not better. Because of child development that I don't understand. So explain it to me. Like, you know, how is earlier not better? Because I think that if they learn to read earlier, they learn to read by kindergarten, then maybe they can start really comprehending what they're reading by first grade. And then they can be writing by second grade. And then now they're a published author by third grade, right? That's my logic, okay? That's my logic.
Interesting that you said they learn to read by kindergarten and maybe they're comprehending it by first grade. Reading is about comprehension. There's no true reading without comprehension. So if you were a policymaker, I would say to you that nature has put a process in place called child development, that the hand is ready for writing when the hand is ready for writing, that children are ready to read when they're ready to read. My favorite professional book was written by neurophysiologist Dr. Carla Hannaford, and she did not read until she was 10. She did okay for herself. She did okay for herself. And the children who are forced to read before they're ready learn to hate reading. Is that what we want? No. And here's another one, Mr. Chaz. Mr. Policymaker.
Okay. I'm not that guy. That's not me.
Okay. By the time they get to third grade, and certainly by middle school, there's no real difference between those who read early and those who read later. It's a washout. And whether we're talking about academics or athletics, the children who begin when they're developmentally ready will catch up to and surpass those children who were encouraged to begin before they were developmentally ready. That's what I would say. Oh, one more thing, Mr. Policymaker. When you're making policy for early childhood education, please, please, please ask the people who are expert in early childhood education. Please.
Yeah. That's why I'm asking you. Now I'm going to take the policymaker hat off because I see that it's getting you. You're getting really dysregulated. And I'm gonna put my Mr. Chaz hat back on.
Okay, good.
So I agree. You said there's no real difference, but maybe the difference might be that the people who were kind of forced to read early, or they were expected to read early before they were ready, that they have this negative feeling about reading in general. And so, while maybe now it's years from now, I wasn't ready to read at kindergarten, but I had all those negative experiences about one, me not being able to read and practicing reading, the expectation of the adults around us. And so I feel like, I can't read, or like other people are starting to read, but I can't do this thing. Like, I definitely don't want to do it. I especially don't want to do it around other people, because that makes me feel worse about myself. But also, like, when you're okay, now you have to read, 10 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, it doesn't matter, read 10 minutes a day, and you're in first grade or your second, you're not ready for that yet. You maybe in third grade, when you're ready to read, you're on test the same that everyone else does, but you have this negative feeling. So while you may test well, when it comes to like, hey, I want to learn about this subject, I want to learn about something, and going to the library and picking up a book to go to read it and consume and learn, which is the reason for reading, right? Not just to take tests, it's to actually, pass and gain information, to learn, to comprehend, right? I love what you said, there's no real reading without comprehension. People are less likely to do that. And which I guess is really good news for Audible, but not necessarily, great for that child who has to, for the rest of their schooling career, be expected to read textbooks or whatever that aren't Audible, that they have to suffer through because they have this in their body, they feel not good about reading.
Right. Well, don't you even have to have a love of learning and that motivation to learn more to want to turn to Audible? I mean, why would you? And the thing we really need to understand about children is that they are born with a love of learning. I mean, it's not with a love of academics. It's with the love of discovery, exploration, investigation, all of that, problem solving, all of that is natural to them. And Mr. Chaz, I can't even tell you how many emails I get from parents and stories I hear from early childhood professionals about children who are burnt out by kindergarten, who were really excited to go to school, because you know, it was cool, and they love learning. And that's what they envisioned it was going to be all about. And then they get there, and it's worksheets and sitting and tests and being asked to do things that you're not ready to do. And they are acting out, burning out. They're miserable. Do we want to create lifelong learners? You know, or what is it we want for our children?
You said something earlier, you know, instead of preparing children for school, why don't we prepare schools for children? What does that, what would a school look like who was prepared for children? Like, what would that look like? What would you, if you were, you know, Ray Pika's Consulting, right? We're trying to get, now I'm a customer. Playing all the roles. We're just playing pretend.
I wish you had a bunch of different hats there.
Yeah, I wish I had a physical hat on. I don't know. I wasn't planning this, but we're just playing. We're in the moment. So now I am an administrator. I'm a principal, or you know, whatever. And I want to get my school ready, children, especially, and maybe even you can even add in. I want to get my school ready for children who had a lot of inconsistencies and maybe have struggled the past year due to all the things that have happened, right? How do I get my school ready for children? What are the conversations that I need to be having with teachers? You know, as maybe as a teacher, what are the, how do I prepare my room? What are some things, maybe mantras to have in mind, some just perspectives, like how do I prepare for the children?
I think that it's easier, you know, than the other way around. I think that play is the most important thing children can do, whether we're talking about, you know, returning from the pandemic, or in general. Again, it's nature's plan that the young of humans, just like the young of almost every other species, is meant to learn through play. You know, I always think about trying to keep kittens and puppies and baby goats from playing and how ludicrous that would be. It should be just as ludicrous to keep children from playing, but that's what's happening. I mean, they're getting just the most minuscule amounts of time for free play these days. So, you know, if I were an administrator talking to my teachers, I would say, meet the children where they're at. You know, I mean, if we're going to test, we're not going to test, we're going to observe. And we're going to assess based on our observations where each child is at, physically, socially, emotionally, cognitively, because all of those domains of child development, they develop at different rates, right?
Yep.
So, you know, you might have the child who's, you know, brilliant physically, but a little socially awkward. So it, you know, and then the other child is exactly the opposite. So meet the children where they're at. But if you have opportunities for play, for exploration, for, you know, for discovery and all of that, the children are going to, no one's going to fail. You know, if they've got the water tables and the sand tables and the dramatic play areas and the block center and all of the things that early childhood education used to have, they're going to, you know, they're going to explore, you're going to discover what their interests are. And the project-based approach, I would highly recommend that. And the project-based approach is simply exploring a topic based on the children's interest. So maybe there's a bird's nest in the tree outside the window, and they are curious about that. Boom, off you go. You know, that is what I would like to see. Gosh, I'd like to see project-based learning all the way up. I mean, because it's our passions that drive us. It's the things that we're curious about. So, yeah.
And I think about, you know, I think part of where people struggle with older ages, and I'll say older ages, I'll say as young as kindergarten up, maybe I think some people can give like, okay, kindergarten every year, but once we start putting numbers in front of your grades, once you start getting to the grades, then no more playtime. It's, you had your transition to your kindergarten, but first grade, no, we're serious, you know, butts in seats, eyes forward. But I think a lot of people struggle kindergarten and up with maybe do more of a project-based approach. And maybe part of the reason why we haven't moved, because these are things that like we know, and I'm sure that of those 130, I don't know how many you said, 132, 135 policymakers, I'm sure someone might have been in their ear or said something at some point about project-based learning, but because there's, well, how do we measure that? How do we know if, you know, how do we know across the school, across the states, how do we compare ourselves to other people and how we're learning? And what are your thoughts on like the need to kind of measure, and can there be, is there a way to measure the project-based approach? Yeah, and one more note that I will say that I just want to highlight, you said before you answer that, I love, like I almost feel like a mantra could be assess, not test, because I think assessing, I mean, you're kind of constantly assessing and like informally assessing, and maybe even more formally, you might be writing some things down, probably writing some things down, but I think that I see those as two very different processes. Maybe a test could be a form of an assessment, but it doesn't have to. I think we're kind of like wrapped up. The only way that we can assess knowledge is through a written test, a Scantron, little bubbles. What are your thoughts on, just say, because I see like the facial expression, so I'm just going to like shut up and let you talk and get it out there.
I have some other facial and hand expressions I could offer.
Well, these aren't right. You know, these, like, you know, this is the way that people are.
Yes, yes.
They're thinking, and yes. It is. These are the barriers to this world of a school that's actually prepares children, right?
Yes, or prepares children for real life, right? Yeah. Yeah. So assess, not test. Yeah. And how about if the assessment is authentic assessment, which means we observe them and we see, you know, what's happening in the moment and how they're reacting to certain things, you know, portfolios, video portfolios, written portfolios, photographs. I mean, all of that, if we need to keep track. We are obsessed with quantifying, measuring things in this country. We give the children more tests than anybody anywhere. And it's not even irony. It's just the disgrace of it is that tests are not indicative of either knowledge or intelligence. It's that simple. They don't really tell us anything except who's good at tests. You know, it's the same with grades. Who's good at tests? Who's a good guesser? You know, who's a good memorizer? Memorization is not learning. It's not authentic learning. So I always bring up Finland. They have very few. I think they have one test in 12 years or something. I mean, you know, they are at the top of the heap in literacy and numeracy, and those children are happy, and they get to learn through play until they're seven. There's no formal instruction until they're seven. I mean, the average age for reading is 6.5. So, you know, why are we in such a hurry for them to read at 3 and 4 and 5? I don't know why we can't look at what's working. It's, I call it You know, I think it was Einstein, somebody who said, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Mm-hmm. For the last, since No Child Left Behind, it's been test, test, test. But, oh, this isn't working. Nothing's improving. This isn't working. Nothing's improving. Let's do more tests. Let's do more tests. Let's do more tests. It's insanity on steroids.
Yeah.
So why don't we look at what is working, for example, in Finland and other, you know, Scandinavian countries?
So you mentioned, and I forget where I was listening to you talk, but I heard you talking a while back, and I think it was a conversation, maybe you were talking about virtual learning, and you said something to the effect of, you know, if we want children to eventually be able to, you know, sit in their seats, that tend to be able to focus and learn, that they need to be playing right now. And they need to be moving around and playing. And I don't remember exactly what you said, but could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's where child development comes in again. There is a process in place that helps children acquire the ability to be still. Being still is a very advanced form of balance. You know, we wouldn't put a toddler on a tightrope.
Yeah.
I really like that. I'm going to use that again. Yeah. I think that's a blog title.
Yeah. That's a tweetable. You can tweet that.
Wouldn't put a toddler on a tightrope tweetable. Yeah, that is good. So anyway, I mean, so why do we expect them to be able to sit still? And you may have heard me talking about, well, there were so many things running through my head. The fact that Finland gives the children a 15-minute recess after every 45 minutes of instruction, how the human body was not meant to sit but meant to move, how children need to physically experience concepts in order to really grasp them, you know. So you may have heard me talking about the children who are falling out of their seats. Maybe it was that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, one first grade teacher counted in a single week. It happened 41 times or 44 times. I mean, whatever it was, if it happened more than once, it's outrageous. And when I tell this story to teachers, they nod their heads. They're seeing it too now. Why is that happening? Because they haven't developed their proprioceptive and vestibular senses. Proprioceptive is the one that lets us know where our body and body parts are in the space around us. I can reach for this bottle of water and bring it to my mouth without looking, because my proprioceptive sense is developed. Vestibular has to do with balance, right? Yeah, yeah. You don't have to watch your feet climbing the stairs, all that sort of thing. So what develops those senses? Movement, spinning, hanging upside down, you know, jumping off of things, running and changing directions, all the things we caution children against these days.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they're getting so little movement that they haven't developed these senses and they're falling out of their chairs. I think it's a travesty what we're doing to human development with the decisions that we're making. And so many of the decisions are based on misinformation, on these myths that are circulating throughout our society. I don't know how they get started, Mr. Chaz. But I'll tell you, the media and social media have done their part in perpetuating them. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And to add to the toddler on a tightrope visualization that you just gave us, it's almost as if we're asking the toddler to sit, don't move. All right, now. It's not even that.
Right.
Asking the toddler to walk on the tightrope, that we're not even doing the things that could potentially help that toddler actually walk on the tightrope. Not only are our expectations out of sync with child development, but also how we're supporting them to meet those expectations are misaligned too. And so it's really not working. And that ends up to being, you know, now they're in kindergarten and then we're asking them to sit for hours and hours upon the day, especially with virtual learning. And man, I think about it like, you know, the reason why I don't like going on long drives is because I don't like to sit for that long. Like, same. I can only go on a drive for as long as I can sit. And even then I'm like readjusting, trying to get comfortable and like laying, absolutely. You know, like I gotta do a whole like lay down thing. Like I'm moving around then. But even then there's a point where like, I just need to get up and stretch my legs because like you said, our bodies are meant to move. I was at a training, maybe last week or two, and it was kind of an all day training and there are breaks in between, but I could feel that like, and when it first got started, I was like, good. And then like 45 minutes in, like I was moving around a little bit more anxious. I would have the break. And then at the beginning of the next part, I'm like a little bit more regulated, a little bit more focused. And then I'm kind of around to balance. And I'm an adult, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm an adult. So like I've had like a lot more time to like to develop and to be able to actually sit still. And I've gone through this whole, and it's just amazing to me that we, how hard it is for us to see how many children struggle with that type of instruction.
Yep.
And I think one thing, and you said that like it would be easier. And I think that it would be easier on, I think it would be easier on the teachers and the children. And I thought it would be we'd get a better result. But I think that it's hard for the people outside of the classrooms to even see, and I don't know like how much of it is just like, well, I suffered through it, so you need to suffer through it too. Like, this is what we do. We suffer through this.
Misery loves company.
Yeah, right. It's, but like, you know, the whole thing of like just playing, like, are they just playing? Like, adults sometimes makes their, I feel like it makes some adults like skin crawl to look into a room or to see children just, or to see children playing in mm-hmm. school. And mm-hmm. they're like, oh, like they're just gonna play. Like, where's the serious work? Like, what, like, there's something about that. And I don't know exactly what it is. If I had to guess, that I think it's maybe adults who are disconnected from play themselves and the messages they've gotten about play.
Yeah, yeah.
But it really irks people to see children in a room playing and enjoying ourselves. And I don't know how much like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what that's about, to
right.
be honest.
100%. I mean, is learning supposed to be miserable? So you hit on two other myths right there. One is that play is not a productive use of time. And this, of course, is related to the earlier is better. Because if we think that, you know, earlier is better, that we have to give them this jump start on success, then we see productivity and accomplishment as more important than something as frivolous as play. But again, nature intended the young of almost all species to learn through play. Okay, the other myth is sitting equals learning. No, it doesn't. I mean, as I mentioned, young children need to physically experience concepts in order to understand them. They need to get up high and down low. Those are quantitative concepts falling under the content area of mathematics. If they act out words like enormous, they never forget enormous. Eric Jensen talks about this, and he says, you know, if you learn to ride a bike and 5 years later you were asked to ride a bike, would you still remember how to do it? He puts it much more eloquently. If you learn the capital of Peru and 5 years later you were asked the capital of Peru, would you still remember what it was? It's the difference between intrinsic learning, the bike riding, versus extrinsic, you know, filling up their heads with stuff. And the reason that we get all fidgety is because again, Eric Jensen, who's written a bazillion books on brain-based learning, the research tells us sitting makes us tired and reduces our ability to concentrate. So why would we ask them to sit more? And that's exactly what we're doing. And why are we asking them to manage something that we as adults, do you think there's an adult out there in the workplace who doesn't take breaks, who doesn't stand when he needs to? I mean, really, yeah. I often say, you know, during one of my live keynotes, if somebody stood up because she needed to stretch while I was talking, would I say to her, hey, you know, sit your bottom back down. You're not, I mean, and that's what we do to children, you know? Yeah. So,
and I don't know if I'm going, look, the revolutionary in me is going to come out a little bit too, because you're about to bring it on a little. I think part of it, so why do we, you were talking about productivity, that we're not being, or it's not seen as productive or as like, as an accomplishment when someone's playing. I think part of that may have to do with the capitalistic kind of culture that a lot of us, at least in the States, have grown up in. They're just like, you have to constantly be producing and be productive and not, and not valuing the moment of like just being present in the moment and enjoying it. And I think that we have a tendency like to learn so much more deeply about the things that we really probably, things that are probably even more important than academics, when we are able to be present in a moment and we're able to engage in conflict. And there's like, that is okay. Like sometimes I think that is part of the learning that we should be doing, a huge part of the learning that we should be doing. And a lot of times when conflict arises, or we just want to distinguish it and just eliminate it and any possibility of any kind of conflict like happening, as opposed to being present in the moment and engaging with it. Because we're like, oh, well, we need to do these academics, or we need to, you know, how are we ever going to, you know, get to multiplication if we don't, you know, if we are stopping to, you know, to be present in a moment and to help, you know, children work out conflict and to, you know, to engage and socialize and to feel safe with each other. But I would argue that that is the work that we really should be doing in schools, and the academics should be completely secondary. And I think once that happens, if that happens, if you prioritize children and people, not just children, but, you know, teachers, everyone feeling safe, and not just physically safe, but, you know, physically, emotionally, socially, cognitively safe, and, you know, playing and engaging, that the lessons are going to come out, like, you know, like in the project-based approach that you referred to, they're going to come out naturally. And to that point, you may not remember Peru if someone told you to memorize it 5 years later, but if you did a whole, if you went to the capital of Peru, or because, you know, budget, we're still going to have our budget, you know, we're not going to take everyone to Peru all the time, but we created our own, I don't even know the capital of Peru, to be honest with you. Maybe I'm sure that I memorized it at some point, but here we are. But if we did like a whole thing where we're experiencing Peru and the capital, and you know, we set up a whole room, and we're, you know, every day we're, you know, creating different cultural pieces that are specific to Peru, and we're eating food that has come from the culture, then 5 years down the line, you're likely going to remember that.
Yeah.
And not just remember, not just remember the role, but so much more, right? Exactly. Of actually what it, the meaning of Peru and the culture, and and you know, exactly. It might actually, then that it might actually inspire you to actually go and fly and go visit Peru and
I came across a story once of a preschool teacher in New Zealand, because there were Kiwis involved, so that's how I remember. And she was meeting with the parents of her kids, and she divided them in half, and half of them were given worksheets with, you know, black and white drawing of Kiwis, and they were given brown and green crayons, told to just, you know, color the Kiwis. The other half were taken out into the hall where there was a Kiwi tree, and they got to taste it and smell it and feel it and, you know, all of that. Now, who do you think learned more about the Kiwis? Yeah, we know, again, research tells us that the more senses we use in the learning process, the more information we retain. Hello, you know.
Yeah.
And that whole thing about productivity, you know, why should productivity and achievement be words associated with childhood? I mean, we don't, as you said, you know, in this country, we're very productivity oriented, and that's great if you're an adult, except that we still need balance. I mean, look at the burnt out adults running around these days, because we don't place any value on leisure and recreation. And we're supposed to, you know, as human beings. And if we as adults are burnt out and unhappy, are we trying to get children on board that train too? I mean, is that what's going on?
That's how you prepare them for life, right? For a miserable life, right? I'm miserable, and I don't have, you know, I don't feel I have any time for leisure. There's any space for leisure. I've been given the message my entire life that life is just about, you know, working. And I think too, that there is a part of this conversation that is very, this whole conversation is cultural, but adding another, like, I think a lot of immigrants or children of immigrant parents get that message a lot of just, you have to, you know, work your butt off.
To achieve the American dream.
To achieve the American dream. And that's when happiness, that's when you can be happy. You can't be happy until you accomplish all these things and you produce all these things. But what ends up happening is they're like, okay, I can't be happy until I graduate, I get straight A's in high school. Okay, I can't be happy until I get an Ivy League. Okay, can't be happy until I have a 4.5. Okay, can't be happy until I have, you know, the job in my field. Okay, can't be happy until I'm at the top. Okay, can't be happy until I own the company and I have millions of dollars. And then we get there and you're like, wait a second, I'm still not happy. Maybe happiness wasn't about those accomplishments, and it was about the process and the moment and the experience, going back to like how we're learning and actually, you know, how we actually learn through the experience and being present in the moment. And all that time is already gone, right? And a lot of people, like sometimes people will, sometimes it happens before you get the millionaire, you know, not everyone becomes a millionaire or whatever, but there comes a certain point in their life. Maybe a big event happens, a pandemic happens, and it forces you to reflect.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, what's my goal here? And we realize that from, and really, I say that it really does start like toddlerhood, infancy. Like I do see it in kind of sometimes the language that we use, just preparing children for the next thing, that we've internalized all these expectations and messages, and we don't even know who we are and right. what we like to do, what lights us up, what fulfills us, how we like to play, how, you know, where our creative side is. We don't even, because we put all that stuff to the back burner, to the side, to focus on those academics, those expectations, and the next thing. And so that's why I think that your message is so powerful.
Thank you. Well, you know, as you were talking, you and I have both been part of the Free to Play Summit. Yeah. And yesterday I was listening to Alfie Cohn's talk with Sally on the Free to Play Summit. And he said when he begins his workshops with parents, you know, he will ask them, what is it they want for their children? What do they want their children to become? You know, and we want them to be happy. We want them to be healthy. We want them to have character. You know, when we think about the things that can't be measured, they are things like resilience, self-reliance, independence, the ability to solve problems and resolve conflict, and you know, all of these traits, all of these character traits that we say we value that mm-hmm. we're not promoting because, you know, they can't be measured, they can't be quantified, and we have to get our priorities straight.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Because I know that it's not at the end of your life. It's not about the numbers. You know, it's about the relationships that we've built. It's about those interactions that we've had, those experiences that we've shared with other people.
Yeah.
And we have done a great job at eliminating or reducing, because I don't think it's completely, because children find a way to play, but severely reducing children's experiences to actually live the fulfilling life, live the meaningful life, live the life of joy. And it's really sad, but it's also something, you know, not even just with early childhood, but I think I see a little bit of a parallel too in just how we engage in a lot of our businesses and not valuing relationships and people. And, you know, the big irony there is that if we did place a higher value on relationships and people and experiences, that it would help the bottom line for whatever company that you're, you know, I don't think there's a single company that I believe, at least, that wouldn't benefit from, you know, the relationship first approach as opposed to numbers first. Right.
And dollars first, right.
Yeah. And so I think that not only, I think everyone kind of has, I think us as a society and all places in society, that we kind of need to take a little bit of a step back and just, and thinking about like, what do we really value? Like what is the, and I'm going to ask you this, and this can be the thing that we, oh man, I want to ask you two more questions. So I got to be quick with here. I got so wrapped up. Quick question. What should be the goal of school?
Not to fit children into molds, you know. I think the goal of school should be to discover and encourage children's likes, their passions, their talents and their skills, not to hurry them up, not to create, you know, successful human beings, but to create human beings who contribute to society and live a fulfilled life.
Yeah. No, that's powerful. Discover and explore their skills and help them develop. Yeah, that's powerful. Now, okay, last question. So, I get to put a hat on for my last question. But don't worry, it's not the policymaker hat. It's the parent hat. So I am the anxious parent hat. So I am anxious. I'm maybe even doubly anxious after listening to this podcast of now, like, oh my goodness, like my child, like all the schools in my area kind of look like have fallen into these and, you know, what the earlier is better, right? And that's what they're promoting. How do I, as a parent, find and identify quality early childhood education or program?
I think the simplest and quickest answer is you look for those that are play oriented and not academics oriented. You know, if you see all the perfect artwork on the walls, if you see behavior charts, run in the other direction, because those just shame children. You know, if you see anything that's academic oriented, if you see the children sitting at desks doing worksheets, run twice as fast, you know. But if you see, if you hear children, that's a good sign. If they are talking to one another, if they are laughing, if there's engagement, you know, you're in the right place. You're in the right place. So, and I would like to add that I've created a program for parents to, you know, to help them see the truth about children.
And talk about it.
Well, it's called The Truth About Children. And I just put the URL in the chat box there. Because I want to help parents understand these myths, and I want to support them on their journey toward, you know, fighting against them, you know, toward doing what's best for their children. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anywhere else we can find you, or anything else that you're, I will put that, I'll make sure to keep that link and add it to the show notes. Anything else you want to talk about with, I know you said that you had a book that you're working on, but I imagine it's not out yet.
Oh, October 2022.
Okay.
It's October 2022. New and big, but it won't be out until October 2022.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, anything you want to know about me and way more, I'm sure, is at raypica.com. It's all there.
Okay. Cool. Awesome. Well, it was such a joy talking to you. I'm so glad that you reached out to me. You've been someone on my list to reach out to and to talk to.
I tend to be a little psychic.
Yeah, you're connected. I don't know. Like, I'm so happy you did. When I saw the message come in from LinkedIn, I was like, oh, she's messaging me. Like, you were on my list.
Right.
And for good reason. I'm so glad that we were able to have this conversation and talk.
Me too.
You know, move people maybe a little bit closer towards the revolution. Okay, cool.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chaz. I appreciate you.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my